Notre Dame and their Center for Education on, no, sorry, Center for Research on Educational Equity. I should be able to say the name of it.
What's the O? Opportunity?
Opportunity. I clearly cannot speak about this at all. Center for Research on Educational Opportunity. That's the O. Thank you.
CREO.
Sorry, guys. I promise I'll be able to speak more eloquently.
I'm David. I'm a dissertator in the department, and I'm also on the market. I plan to be done.
And I'm Pam Oliver, and I'm the instructor of record for this. And because there's some new people, I want to take care of a couple bits of business while we see if people trickle in. Anybody enrolled in this?
I am. You are.
Mm-hmm. And you're just visiting. That's good.
Yeah.
Visitors are welcome. It's just enrollees. So you need to make sure you talk to me. Another thing is, did you get the email today telling you what was going to happen today? And if you got it?
I did.
So let me get you. What I want to do is add, is there anybody else besides Julie who's not on the list?
Okay. Or when did you send the email?
Today.
At what
this
time?
Morning.
Oh, okay, no, I didn't get it.
I thought because you might not. So what I'm going to do is just type in your email address right now. So what is your email address?
J. Markussen.
M-A-R.
K-U-S-S-E-N at was
this one. Sociology. Okay.
And Julie Markussen.
Well, yeah. Now I'm not really.
Here?
Yeah.
At Notre Dame, I'm not really in a disciplinary department.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But cross paths with education people in various departments as well.
I'm sure.
And Julie and James, we also have slots this semester for people who want to present any of their research or their ideas they're working on, or they want to brainstorm, or they want some preliminary advice on the early stages of the work, or if they have more advanced findings they want to present. So it's a good space to do that.
If you look at our website, you can see the open dates. I just booked somebody this morning, actually.
Okay.
I talked Yang Xiaozhang into speaking on October 26th. And another administrative thing, I can also, if nobody here wants to do it, I can backstage check with people. But FemSAM has used an event calendar plugin for their website, which has the advantage that once you get it running, it generates Google Calendar entries that people can, you know, subscribe to and update their calendar with exactly what the program is for a given week. And Katie says it's pretty easy to use, so I don't mind doing it myself when I get time, but that's likely to be a while because I'm department chair. And so just if there's somebody who's interested in talking to Katie to figure out what she did and then implementing that on our website. That's a thing that somebody's...
What's it called again? Google?
Well, there's a plug-in to WordPress that's called Event Something. Mm. And once it's in there, it puts a really nice calendar. The calendar entries look really pretty on your website, and it automatically generates the feed that will feed into people's Google Calendar so that they can subscribe to it and have the updates to what's going to happen in the brown bags show up in their calendars.
I'll check on her.
Yeah, and so Katie, you know, you can look at the FemSAM site and see what they're doing. And then if you like that, it's ask Katie what did she do and put it in our site.
I'll do that. Okay, well, today we're going to be talking about all the housekeeping stuff.
I think so. Is there anything else that...
No. Okay. So today we're going to do, this is a kind of professional development session of the brown bag. And basically, we were kicking around ideas last time about what people wanted to talk about because we didn't have a speaker lined up for this time. And so we came up with an idea of like having a talk by some senior people in the grad students who've been in the job market, had experience going in the job market, and have some things to share with the younger students or students who have yet to go on the market, both about their experience recently, like what they did, they felt was good, what they wish they could have done better or wish they could have done in hindsight, and also things that they might have done or they did do early on in their career. So basically the most recent experience in the job market and also things that you did or did not do early on in the career that maybe, you know, that was a good thing I did back then, or things I wish I could have done, would have done differently if I had the chance to do it all over again. And then we thought we'd switch the conversation in the second half to talking about questions from people who are just like, you know, in a mid-stage or early in their career as grad students and say like, okay, what kind of things do you want to, question you have to be answered and think the things you'd be thinking about, how to, I mean, some of the things were how to choose a research topic. Some of the issues we brought up last time was how to develop your identity as a scholar vis-a-vis other fields. There's some other things. For those who were here last time, did I catch them all, or there were some of them?
I think one of them too is kind of how to be involved in the community and how that works with your own research.
Right. And about, yeah, how to be involved in the community as well as the balance between like community activism or involvement and your research, and also a balance between your identity as a scholar and also your politics, I think was mentioned. Like, if your politics are somewhat, like, how do you balance, how do you diplomatically engage your politics and stay true to your politics and principles while at the same time being a scholar and interacting with people who may or may not share your worldview. I think that kind of summarizes what we kind of wanted to talk about. But before we get to that, let's talk about job market and people who have just been on the job market. I invited David and Rachel to come and give their experiences. And I also been on the market, so maybe I can start first, just give a little example of what we're talking about. So I'm on the market this year, went to ASA, I felt I had a good experience. I was there for 2 days, I had 8 interviews. The ASA, for those of you who don't know, is the annual meeting for sociologists, and they have a formal service called the employment service that people use to obtain informal interviews with potential employers, and that's a very useful device, I think. A lot of schools use them, a lot of schools don't use them, avoid using it at all. It's a lot of more like, just generally as a rule, like the top tier schools avoid using the employment service, so it's like mostly middle-range schools that use the employment service, which are 20-minute interviews, and you have to sign up, and they orient you, and there's a gong, actually, that tells you when you have to leave, get up out of your chair, because like this table, it's a room full of tables, and it's like little numbers on the table, and you have to find out which school is attached to the number, you have to go down for 20 minutes, be grilled, ask questions, and then a gong goes and you walk up and leave.
The warning bell.
The warning bell. There's a warning bell.
You get a warning bell before you get the gong.
Yeah, that's right. And I did 2 interviews through that. One of them, which I organized myself. I sent the employer email, and they contacted me. Another, the employer contacted me. So the ASA, they have a website, they have a portal where you upload your resume and your description, what kind of jobs you are. And employers can see that and like, you know, say, oh, this person looks interesting, I'm going to ask them to come to interview for our department. So that can happen, otherwise it goes vice versa. It's like a matching game. But I feel like I had the most success, actually, is by emailing department chairs in advance, like a week or two in advance. Some people should say you should do it longer in advance, but I emailed several department chairs. I gave a little short email, like, I'm interested in meeting with you. I gave a little bio, a little short paragraph of my research. And I left to meet the representative of your department. And I got 5 interviews that way. And they were good interviews. And I got really useful and helpful tips from people from those departments based on those interviews. And I also got a kind of sense of how they are assessing me, because I emailed them and I also attached my CV. So they have a sense of where I am as a candidate. So they're able to size me up, and based on I have some tells about where they think I am relative to whether they want me strongly or not. And that was really useful information. It's very kind of informal, nonverbal information I got from the departments. And when I came to this is my year where I actually did a serious job market launch. So I went to the ASA. I really didn't do any of the other panels. I just like was focused like a laser on getting ready for interviews, meeting people, and I felt that was the best use of my time.
Did you feel ready for the market?
I did. That's another really important thing too. Like, I think last year I did a kind of what they call a soft launch, which I applied. I wasn't really ready in like September. Like, I was kind of maybe ready in October, and I applied for some postdocs and I applied for some jobs here and there. but I wasn't as ready as I am this year. And this year I felt it, and I actually kind of feel like I embodied it in my persona and how I talked about my work. And one of the things I did to prepare for the ASA particularly was just really go over my work, my research statements, my dissertation proposal, my findings, and just like really kind of like, I had to own like why my work is important. I had to be my own champion for my work. And that, and like, I think my work's exciting, you know, and that's mm-hmm. independent of myself, you know, whatever expectations I have of you, department person. And I feel like I gave off that vibe. Mm-hmm. I think that was a very important element to a lot of the good reception I received from people.
So, just a comment, if you don't mind.
Sure, no problem.
I'm really glad it worked out, and it sounds like you did it really well. Usually people don't email the department chairs on their own behalf. Usually your advisor's supposed to do it for you. And and asking your advisor to do it, like I've had on the ball, like you, on the ball advisees who would come to me and say, look, here's the list of people I want you to email. You know, and then I would suggest you contact this person. It's interesting that a direct contact by yourself worked, and it's really good that you it sounds like it's really good that you did it. It just makes me nervous when I hear about it, because I can imagine some people might have thought it's a little too forward or unexpected. But on the other hand, it sounds like if you got 5 of 8 positive responses, then you obviously did it in a really professional, well done way that, you know, hit people right. So that's, I think, really interesting.
I contacted people directly and had a similar experience.
Interesting. So, see, this shows what I know.
And one of them ended up last year getting to a phone interview. Not beyond that, but it couldn't have gone that badly.
Right.
So, and did you craft the emails kind of on your own? Did you have a template?
I followed a similar format. I don't know if I looked somewhere for that. I just think that was sort of what made sense. Mm-hmm. And just very much like being aware, you know, that it might not work out, and being clear that like I'm asking for their time to learn more about the position was kind of the way that I framed those emails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I usually use a template email. I had like a basic introduction followed by a short paragraph mm-hmm. about my research. This is how you can contact me if you just want to see me. And I just changed, you know, the dear or so, dear, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and it was formal but brief, and it was informal. I mean, it was formal and brief,
yeah.
And I just, because it's just a visit, we just kind of get to meet,
mm-hmm.
so, yeah. And I know a friend of mine who's also in the job market from some other institution who didn't do that because she felt she had to craft, really learn about the department, craft a more detailed letter. It's like these chairs, they don't care. I mean, you show them you're serious about your letter by being more professional, but you don't have to go overboard and like put labor it to death, you know.
And I didn't contact chairs. I found whoever from the department did work that was most closely related to mine was the person that I contacted. So, I mean, you often can't tell like who's on the search committee.
Yeah.
So it was more about just trying to find somebody to learn more about it. And I mean, I feel like the most useful thing that I got out of that is, I mean, there's a chance that, like, I think in the case where I got the phone interview, the person that I talked to seemed pretty excited and like encouraged me very strongly to apply. Mm. And I think maybe that helped. But I think the more helpful information that I got in general was getting a sense of what they're looking for and what they need. Like if they emphasize, oh, well, can you teach this class that nobody wants to teach?
Yeah.
And sort of being able to know that that's something that you can cue in your materials,
right.
That you can do certain things, or that, you know, if they really, you know, one of the schools, they were talking about how much they really wanted someone to do research in the local school. So I made sure to talk about that in my research statement.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that kind of stuff that you just don't get in the materials from the school, can be one of the best things about that.
Yeah, I didn't meet the chair of one department, but I met someone who used to be a formal student in our department, Philip Brenner of UMass Boston. And there was a job there that the announcement said race, ethnicity, and or urban sociology, secondary interests, social theory. And I met with him one-on-one, and he said, well, really what we want is if we had to choose between race and ethnicity and urban and race and ethnicity and someone could teach social theory, we go for the social theory because we really need that someone to teach that. So even though in the announcement it seems like urban sociology was preeminent over social theory, he gave me the DL download that actually we really need a social to teach this class. And so, yeah, in my letter to that department, I sure as hell emphasized I could teach social theory, I could love this class in my background. So that was very useful information.
Just, this may or may not be helpful in this millennium, but back when I was on the market in 1980, wow. one of the things that happened, the job I actually got, but it confused them because I applied for both their jobs. They had a theory job and a methods job, and I thought, well, I can do methods and I can do theory, right? So I kind of, and it confused their system because they had this, in their thinking, they were discrete positions. They weren't just looking for somebody and here's some things that we can cover and we'll figure out how to do two people. So, and I've talked to some schools I think are more slotted in terms of their conception of what is this position than other schools are. Another thing that a friend of mine who was at a small school told me is they advertise with one configuration of stuff, and then they had a person quit, and so by the time they were interviewing, what they were actually looking for was a different configuration of stuff. And I also learned from her that in small departments, they often will cancel you out if you look like you overlap too closely with somebody who's already there, because they don't want people fighting over courses. So especially in the smaller departments, it can often be kind of crazy what they're actually looking for and moving.
Which is so frustrating. I feel like last year, I told myself I was only going to do a soft launch, and I ended up just like applying for everything that maybe sort of I did, thinking this kind of thing where maybe they're posting one thing and they really care about something else, so I'll just apply for everything, and it kind of made me feel crazy. And so this year I said I'm going to do, because I have a one-year postdoc, now that I'm on the job market again, I said I'm going to apply more narrowly, but then I still have the same worries that you just never know. So I'm telling myself that if it requires a very specialized application and it's only sort of barely a fit, then I'm not going to spend the time to create extra materials. But if it's just like a little bit of tailoring in the letter, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Debbie, what?
Yeah, no, I think my experience was, so one, like with the employment service, that was really crazy because I thought once you just paid for it, it was like magically there. I didn't realize like you had to upload your CV and then that there was like, you might actually contact people. So I had heard that it's sometimes better to have like informal meetings with people that are at the employment service rather than going through the employment service, because the employment service, it's like a 20-minute, like you have 20 minutes and that's it.
Speed date.
Yeah, and so, but the people that I contacted out that were also at the employment service was like, look, are you doing the employment service? We'd much rather do that. If you don't have time during the employment service, then we can set up something. So I had my advisors set up meetings for me prior to ASA, and then I set up basically all the appointments that I have through the employment service were set up because I emailed the... I contacted them through the employment service website, being like, I'm interested in your position, here's a short paragraph, and then scheduled interviews like that. And so, I didn't wait for anybody to contact me. I contacted them directly to set up those appointments. And then my advisor had meetings set up for me with some different departments that weren't participating in the employment service. And what else did I do? Oh. Yeah, I mean, so I think, like, the actual mechanics of the employment service. So I did a master's at a terminal. I got a terminal master's before I started this program. And so I had a mock employment service interview set up through the faculty that I knew there. So they got two people from their department to kind of run me through the ringer, like actually have like a time, 20-minute, we're going to do the bells and whistles so that you get a sense about how much time you have to, which obviously would be really helpful if Wisconsin does that, because not all of us are going to be at R1 institutions, and a lot of us are going to participate in through the employment service. So going through a mock employment service interview where I knew how much the time was, and then it was actually, so then they gave me feedback being like, this is what you need to clean up, this is what you need to, how you can frame, you know, things that we see as disadvantages about you going on the job market, about stuff, and how you can turn that into something that's a positive instead of using the framing that you use. And so going, having that experience was really helpful because it both gave me a timeline to figure out how much is 20 minutes, what does that look like, and then also just presentation, how to do it really well, how to be able to be very concise. And then also I had faculty say, you know, think about your dissertation in very few words. Think about how you would describe your work and who you are. Because in one of my very first employment interview services, they said, in two sentences, tell me about your work. And, you know, because I had prepared, I was like, okay, I have a very two-sentence spiel about how I describe what I do and what I work, how my work is how I view myself as a scholar or whatever. So that was really helpful. So thinking about, like, before you go to whatever job market activities you're going to be engaged in, preparing, you know, like you would prepare for a presentation. It's like you're preparing for all those kind of things.
So if I can back us up, I'm hearing people talking about actually being on the market. But as somebody who's both been on search committees and who's dealt with tons of students on the market, I'd like to back you up a year, because candidly, I've dealt with a lot of students who were clueless about what they needed to be ready for the market, and other students who were like so totally on the ball, they were just giving me orders and marching me around. And similarly, in reading application files, you see people who are kind of clueless and people who really have it put together. So my checklist of things you need. One is you need your reference letters. I always think about that because I write them. Which means that 3 years ago, you were cultivating the relationships that would end up being reference letters rather than suddenly pouncing on somebody that you've never talked to for the last 3 years and asking them for a reference letter. And believe me, it's happened both ways. I have had people pounce on me and ask me for a reference letter that I have never read anything they've written, and they ask me for a reference letter. So, that would be like 3 years ago, you were thinking about, or you didn't have to think about it because it just happened, but you were cultivating those letter writers. You have to have your research and publications ready to share. David already mentioned you have to have your verbal ability to talk about yourself ready to go. You have to have kind of these packages of your research agenda and your teaching agenda and all this other stuff ready to go. And kind of your, I've just finished reading The Professor Is In, which I do recommend, your self-packaging, like how do you define yourself as a scholar? How can you think about who you are and interface yourself with the world of jobs has to be ready to go. Do you guys want to, you're nodding at me. Can you reflect on how backing up a couple of years you were doing things that put you in a position to feel like you were ready for the job market? Or alternately, things that panicked you at the end because you hadn't been thinking about it far enough in advance that if you had it to do over, you could have backed up 2 or 3 years and put yourself in a better position.
I mean, I feel like the department doesn't say you're ready for the market. It says you've been here for X number of years. You need to be on the market, and it doesn't look at.
So it's kicking you out of the nest. That's right.
Yeah, and so it doesn't look at like the training or the preparation for being on the market. It's more of like a numerical indicator. You've been here X many of years. Your next year will be on the market. Kind of is the sense that I get. I think looking back 3 years ago, like what I would have done or how I would do it to prepare for the market. You know, it's hard. I mean, I think it's hard to know. You know, people are gonna tell you you need to publish, you need to have publications or whatever. But you know, it's like publications don't happen overnight. You know, my first publication that was that came out in 2014 started in 2009, like with actually the research and the data. You know, so it's like, well, you know, that's a pretty long time from start to finish. So when you're telling me if I'm going to be done in 5 years, if I'm a first year or second year, that I needed to start my papers, you know, long before that. You know, and I think as graduate students, sometimes it takes us a little bit longer than as a professor who are kind of already knows how to situate themselves in the field, who knows what the sociologically interesting questions are. And so there's a, you know, I think in year three, to begin preparation for a job market that is 3 or 4 years away, it's really difficult. You know, I think learning what the process of publishing is really important. Learning, you know, again, one of the questions was like, how do you know what is like a sociological, one of the setups for the mm-hmm. for the discussion today was like how to figure out what is a sociologically interesting question. You know, I think that takes like a really long time to develop. Or at least for me, it took a long time to figure out what was sociologically interesting. And so I don't know, like 3 years from 3 years ago, I would have been able to say, this is going to make an impact in sociology because I know what the puzzle is and, right. and how I'm going to contribute to that puzzle. It's not advice. It's just saying that it's really difficult to be instrumental.
There's publications. There's also letters, statements, packaging, elevator speeches. Anyway.
And I think that process can be, I don't know, I found it really psychologically challenging to take that perspective. I enjoyed graduate school until I started thinking about the job market. I was enjoying the work that I was doing, and I felt like I like had a good handle on work-life balance and figuring out what I was doing and just sort of like, you know, being like doing the work that I was doing and wanting to contribute and wanting to, like, you know, do good research. And I feel like once I started thinking about this as like a tool and thinking about my relationships as something that were something that I needed to cultivate for like a purpose for myself later on, I started really hating what I was doing. And so for me, I feel really lucky that certain things sort of fell into place, that I had relationships and that I was doing research that I really needed funding to do. And so I was applying for grants and I was doing things that I think are good for the job market. Mm-hmm. But I just couldn't think about them in terms of the job market before that. And so I think that's one of the parts that's so hard about it. But if I could have gotten a little bit of that, I think not waiting for research to be perfect before trying to send it out to journals to get things out earlier is definitely something that I would have done differently.
Well, I think, so cultivating relationships, so I just focus on publications, but cultivating relationships with faculty is something that can begin, you know, the minute you get here. And I think participating in committees, being in, engaging in other activities like going to brown bags, all these become avenues where you can establish relationships with faculty.
And reputation.
What's that?
And reputation. You know, yourself, like you as a person, you a reputation, I'm sorry to cut in, but just your reputation as a scholar, as a thinker, and as a mm-hmm. participant in the scholarly community, that's important.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is, you know, being able to engage in faculty in different forums so that they can take an interest in you. And then the other thing, too, is to make sure that, you know, you're demanding of their time, and I think, you know, they're not going to demand your time. They're not going to be banging on your door being like, I really, really want to meet with you because I really, really like you. So part of it is that, you know, the students, I was telling somebody earlier that if you don't feel like you're burdening the professor by demanding their time, then you're not demanding enough time from them. So you should make it a point where you feel uncomfortable that you're asking for so much time from this faculty member. That lets you know that you're asking enough time from the faculty member to be able to cultivate that relationship. Because I think, for the most part, that doesn't happen with the way graduate students interact with faculty. I think faculty are kind of more hands-off, and so students are like, oh, they're not real hands-on because, you know, I meet with them once, when it's like, well, you know, being more demanding of that time is really important, of their time. And whether they might be reluctant about it, but, you know, you just need to make sure that it's not about them, it's about you, and it's about cultivating that relationship so that they get to know you and that you get the mentoring and training that you need from different faculty. It's not just like one faculty person to be the end-all be-all for that, but to cultivate all those relationships with various faculty.
Mm-hmm. And I think depending on, I'm not on the job market yet, but I think, too, something that I would have told myself years before in preparation for it is just that cultivating relationships. But also, I guess I thought about, I'd heard advice like this, I'd been to panels like this, and said, okay, I need reference letters, like, okay, I think I know faculty enough and I'll continue those relationships and I can get reference letters. But even now, thinking back to that, what that means, also in terms of publications, it's a little bit of a different relationship. So I took classes from professors and I know them, and, you know, or I TA'd for them or something like that, and they know me and I know them, but, you know, have we gotten to have a relationship where I'm researching with them, or I'm working on a project with them, or they've read, you know, drafts of my work, either because they're on my committee or not. And so really that's kind of at least what I struggle with, and what David was saying too about, you know, feeling I'm the type of person who won't ask for things until it's, you know, the appropriate time to ask, like, oh, I'm trying to do this task, can you help me with this? But really I should have been doing that long before, if not just to kind of keep those relationships going. And we don't have that model really in this department, in terms of, you know, right when you come in, you're working with a professor and you're going to work on their projects. And other departments do have that. And so if that's the kind of thing that you think will help you in terms of thinking of ideas for your own work, even if it's not directly related, or through consulting work, I've like found many ideas for my own research, even though the consulting work had nothing to do with any of my research. So just getting that practice, I think, is really important. And so if there's a professor that you know is doing work that you're really interested in, is working on a project, you know, contact them. Mm-hmm. You know, be, you know, appropriately aggressive about it, you know. And so professionally aggressive is kind of what I call it. And so, you know, don't, again, what David was saying, basically, don't wait till they ask you or wait till they make a call out, you know, on for a job. You know, contact them, tell them you're interested in it and why, you know, why you would be a benefit.
Yeah.
Those are things I wish I had done earlier on.
I think I saw, were you indicating you wanted to ask a question?
Yeah, so I guess I'm in the very beginning of this process and going to the, like, discussing, like, feeling overwhelmed by all the faculty that I'm talking to all the time, and how do you actually cultivate real relationships, and how to know which relationships are the ones that you actually want to cultivate, and, like, the ones that you have to participate in to just, like, be the, like, I'm maintaining a professional attitude, this is my career, and I'm maintaining this relationship as a professional relationship, rather than, like, necessarily, like, an intellectual relationship, and stuff like that. How do you navigate all those things?
I would say try not to overthink it.
Yeah.
you know, let your interests, you know, decide for you. You know, what your research, what motivates your research, what motivates your questioning as a sociologist, and who in your department matches that the best way you can, and through that shared mutual interest in that particular subject, that should be the basis of your connection. And that hopefully that's something you can share, and they can see what the questions that you're doing, why they're interesting or not, you know.
So I guess I'm going to just say it very candidly then, is that, so, like, I am in, so I'm on the demography track, and there's a lot of faculty that, I think that's more of, like, a methodological reason why I'm on that track. I'm quantitative, that's a lot of, like, the strong quantitative faculty are there, but, like, a lot of the intellectual questions are, like, faculty that I'm interested in are outside demography, yeah. And so is it more just, like, really... I don't know.
All the above.
Yeah, all of
it.
What's that?
I'm sorry, what were you going to say? Is it more like a division?
It feels like very disjointed for me right now.
I was going to say, I feel sort of qualified to address some of these issues from the other side of the table.
Yeah.
One thing to tell you is I wrote an essay called How to Be a Good Advisee.
Yeah.
So I think it's about building relationships, but it's not like one person is going to be everything to you.
Right.
So the good advisee is like not specifically the advisor relationship, but I have over the years I have some students I mentor only on a professional basis.
Mm-hmm.
They ask me advice about teaching or managing people or the market or something. We have no intellectual interests in common, but we talk about professional issues. There's in terms of the structure of this department. Lots of demography students also work with people who are not demography, and the other way around. I mean, the chaotic the seeming chaotic structure of the department that confuses the students, the plus to it is it's very easy actually to work with faculty from different sub areas of the department. It's really not a problem, and there are quite a few students over the years who've done that. They often will have some people who are on the committee who are kind of their methods experts and other people who are the intellectual experts, and that's a very common way that students negotiate the program. Mm-hmm. There's also stuff about learning. Each one of us is weird and different, just like each one of you is weird and different. You know, I'm very students who work with me figure out that I answer email. You know, and so I had one of my most successful students, he's now provost, actually, just got through the program in 5 years, out the door, sent me emails all the time asking questions about this, that, and the other thing. You know, he just assumed that they were short, they were quick, they weren't, I mean, sometimes you would actually, he was also, he'd whine and complain about things that really bugged him. You know, it wasn't all happy talk. But he was constantly asking my advice about stuff. And it didn't, because the questions actually seemed like questions that deserved answers. You know, I mean, there's, if somebody says, you know, I don't know, there's certain kinds of questions that might annoy you if the kind of question is like, you know, so how can I get out of doing all the requirements or something? But if it's a, you know, a question that you think the person deserves an answer to, yeah, that's a good question, then you tend to want to answer them. And so you sort of, I feel like people have, I've gotten to know a lot of students, and some of them are my advisees. I work with some people that I share intellectual interests with. I work with other people because nobody else shares their intellectual interests, and so I work with them. You know, and faculty do differ in terms of how Catholic they are and their willingness to work with students outside of their own wheelhouse. But that's one of the things that you can find out by talking to people. It is scary. I'm reminded, so I'm like really, really shy. You may not believe this, but I am actually really terrified. Not terrified, yeah, sort of terrified of people, but also just really shy. And I've learned about myself that I hate international travel by myself. And I'm not one of those people who just loves to go out and meet people. I'm like, oh God. And I was talking to people who do it. And what they, I said, how do you talk to people in a foreign country? Like, how do you even start? And he said, well, what you have to do is be very tolerant of rejection. You just start lots of conversations with lots of people with these very superficial things, and they either brush you off or they answer, and in a small proportion of these interactions turn out to be longer. Now, hopefully it would be not quite the same as approaching strangers, but if you think of it as you start with a kind of low-stakes conversation about just getting to know you, want to get to know you, mm-hmm. and it gradually increases. That's how I think about it. I mean, I've had some... So another thing that impresses me about students, if I can just say this, the students that I think of as, over the years, I've always been really impressed with, are the ones that every time they come back to me, there's something new to talk about. And I've also, students who initially have struggled a lot, I can really see their progress, and that makes me feel good. So it's not like only the students who were brilliant from the, you know what I mean? There's some people who kind of walk in the door kind of like stars, and so those are easy to work with. But students who really struggled in the first few years, I still really bonded with because I could tell they were working really hard. And every time they came back to me, there was progress. And so I felt like, oh, okay. You know, this person's really worth working with. It's worth me investing in this person because they're investing. The students that kind of turn me off over time are the students who just, I don't know, seem kind of passive, and they seem like they're not doing anything, so why should I do anything? Hmm. If I can be candid about it. You know, and I feel like it's that dyadic thing that advising is rewarding, but it's a kind of caregiving, nurturing reward, which means that the interaction is coming from watching the person grow. It's also true that the students who, a lot of students who work with me start giving me advice because they know I'm kind of a lunatic, and so, you know, it becomes dyadic after a while. It's not just all one way, depending on the personality of the student, but it builds over time. It's not like the first time you talk to somebody that you decide that minute whether this is going to be a long-term relationship or not. It kind of...
I mean, I think the big thing is you know, Pam's really talking about, you know, not letting the bounds of some sort of idea about a structure, about who faculty are in a specific area, dictate the relationships that you establish. You know, and I think, and the other thing too is that, you know, you can use faculty with different relationships. It's not like you need to have substantive relationships with all the mm-hmm. all the faculty. Not, you don't need to be best friends with all the faculty. You need those that are going to provide you the support you need. You need those that are going to provide you the intellectual support and the rigor. And you're going to need those that, you know, the ones that challenge your work and say it's not very good. And, you know, it's, so it's like, once you go to the one that tells you your work's not very good, you need to go to the other two. I need your help emotionally, because I'm not feeling very good about myself. And then you go to the other one that says, okay, this is the way that you can think about your ideas, so that then you can think about back to the third one that says that you don't have good ideas. You know, but that's not bound by like some discipline or some programmatic area of the department or whatever. And so, you know, again, like thinking about brown bags, thinking about different ways to establish those relationships with faculty. I think I took a class with Pam on social movements, and so I transitioned from asking Pam about social movements to being like, I don't know how well I fit here. I'm really struggling with my first year or two. I don't know if people think that my work is any good. And so it transitioned from it being about work to it just being kind of like emotional support. And so it was really helpful at that time to kind of get me through that next step or whatever. And so, you know, it's not like, so then, you know, and then I served on other committees with Pam and worked with her, but it wasn't like I kept on going back to her. It's like, you know, sometimes you can just use faculty to, at certain points in time, for the help that you need. It doesn't have to be like a long-term commitment or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And people in much smaller departments don't have so many areas of research to pick from, so I think I thought about it that way when I was figuring out who I wanted to work with, that oftentimes people in much smaller graduate programs just have to pick somebody that they get along with. And I think, like, I took Myra's methods class and I just liked interacting with her, and I felt like she pushed my work in a way that I felt was good for it, and so I continued to ask her to read my work and be on my committees. So yeah, it really doesn't need to be by what you do. I do think, like, looking back, I think that the people that I that write my letters are good people to write letters. And I do know that people have varying experiences in terms of not necessarily the letter writing, but in terms of how connected faculty are and how much they engage at meetings and things like that. And so I think that can be something to take into account, that you are connecting with some well-connected faculty members, that, because those kinds of things are very helpful for getting jobs.
Mm-hmm. There's also, there's connections and productivity. You know, so there's, another resource that's out there. I mean, I recommend to a lot of people Fabio Rojas's Grad School Rules, which I don't agree with everything in, but I mean, he's got just stuff. There's a chapter on choosing an advisor, like what's the checklist of stuff to look for, you know. I will stress that, you know, notice that the theme here that I've heard everybody, you started with it when you were doing job market stuff, and then it's exploring. It is taking initiative and taking control of your life, and not waiting around for somebody else to tell you what to do or to give you permission to do stuff, but just saying, okay, here's what I need to do, and I'm going to start doing what I need to do. And students gossip about advisors, which is wise, but it's also important to remember that it is relational, and so the same advisor that's a really good advisor for one student could be really a terrible advisor for somebody else. Both in terms of, you know, I remember still, you know, years ago there was a student I worked with on the master's project, and she got very frustrated because she felt like I wasn't really engaging her project. Now, I actually engaged it a lot. It's just that she didn't like my suggestions, so she didn't take them. And so she did another project, which was perfectly fine. I was happy to sign it, but it just wasn't my intellectual agenda. I wasn't engaging her project. I would have taken the project in another way. So she got really frustrated. She moved on and was happier with another advisor for dissertation. And that really wasn't, it was just a bad intellectual fit. You know, and being willing to just make those judgments. Or similarly, sometimes there's bad personality fits. You know, different advisor styles, and you may be more comfortable with one advisor style rather than another. And so sometimes you have to take some direction yourself. I mean, some people, one of the things I've been known to do over the years is give people backstage advice about how to negotiate complicated relationships, like the person who really needs to be their advisor is a problem for them, and is there some way they can deal with that problem? But it is feeling, you're not used to feeling in control, and particularly depending on your background, the less privileged your background, the less likely you are to just assume that you're in control of your own life. But ultimately, getting to the point where you can see yourself as a choice maker and an initiator of action instead of just a victim or a target of action can help.
If this is not interesting to other people, that's fine. But I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about how to choose your research topics and how to situate yourself in an intellectual community.
People have, anybody got thoughts on that? Why don't I start with, as the professor, some meta, and then maybe people will get. Because it is really hard. And somehow you need to get the vision of what the rest of the field, or at least some subfield, looks like so that you can imagine yourself in dialogue with some other people. And that, so how do you get that, I guess? One way of getting it is to get in dialogue with people so that you are hearing what other people think are researchable ideas, and you're hearing discussion of researchable ideas. You're reading the journals, so that you're reading published research. And so, I mean, I realize it's not a template, but it does seem to me that at some point it is partly something you absorb by just being in an intellectual community enough. Some of the faculty are better than others at helping you do that. So, like, Jerry Marwell passed away, but for years, Jerry Marwell and I worked together, but we had a lot of students in common. And whenever one of my weaknesses as a scholar is I'm not good at organizing a project up front and figuring out how to get it laid out so it's a guaranteed win. My own projects have often, some of them have won and some of them have lost, but they tended to just unfold. So, but I used to always send all my advisees to Jerry because that was what he was really good at. And so they would take their kind of squishy, amorphous idea, and he would bang it around enough until it turned into something more researchable. Myra's better at that. You know what I mean? So one of the things is that different people, I'm really good, personally, I'm not a terrible, I'm actually quite helpful to people once the project is launched in revising it into getting it done as a good project. I'm just not good at always envisioning it up front. So you could kind of, I realize I'm giving a backwards example, but you know, you get advice from different people. So you take in your idea to the faculty and you listen to what they say. Jerry used to say to people, okay, that's a great topic, but it's still not a research problem. It's a topic. You know, a research problem is a research question that has, there's some reason to do the research because you don't already know the answer. And then you're trying to think about why it would be interesting to other people, which involves knowing a literature and how it might fit into a literature. Now, most first-year students aren't going to know that. So then the next question is, well, how do I get going on research in my first and second years when I actually don't know that yet? And in CDE, how that happens is that the first and second-year students are working on projects designed by other people. And so initially, they're not working on their own research. They're working on somebody else's research, and that puts them in a community where they can start absorbing what's a research project, researchable topic, by hanging out with other people. My own view is that one of the problems we have in this department is more the eighth floor aura has less of that, where people just get plugged into other people's research projects and start learning it that way. And so I've actually been trying to figure out, talking to people about other ways that we could be better on the eighth floor, creating those comparable kinds of experiences where you plug in. Some departments encourage models of senior students working with junior students. I mean, like more advanced graduate students who have a research project in mind, collaborating with a less advanced student where it's a student-student project, but it's they're moving forward. It's often these are pretty small projects, not necessarily your dissertation or your life's work, but something that kind of moves forward. Or that, especially in your early years, students may think of a more modest project that's kind of too small, really, to make your career on, but it's a way to learn a research project and do something. I didn't totally answer your question, but maybe I sort of got us going in terms of things that people might think about. More senior students, in your own experiences, how you develop the sense of what's a research problem.
I think you sparked some thoughts for me about how, I mean, so I think I came to grad school thinking I wanted to study something else from what I ended up studying. I mean, I did end up working on social capital, but that's what I thought that I wanted to do with graduate school and with my dissertation eventually, if I was thinking that far. But I ended up going back to like an area of topical interest for me where I had taught special ed before, and there were questions that I had about race and special education that I think that the best advice that someone could have given me early on was, like, don't ignore these obvious questions you have about the world. And you have things you're interested in topically. And I think it's the thing that's kept me motivated, that it has a practical application that's important to real people. And it's allowed me to, I feel like it allows me to stay on it and keep coming up with new questions because I just keep feeling like it's not answered. And then it wasn't until I think I really took my prelims that I started seeing where it fit in more theoretically, and I think it helped me frame it differently. I mean, I don't even think when we talked about framing our work, I have a different framing now than I had last year when I was on the job market because I didn't really know what my dissertation said until it was done. And so I think figuring out where your work fits and what the question is, I think you can figure out where it fits methodologically or theoretically after you already know that there's a real problem that you want to answer. I know not everybody goes about it that way, but for me that made the most sense.
I think in education too is probably more rooted in a social problem, and you can see how others have attacked that social problem. But it's in sociology it's a little bit different because the social problem would motivate what is sociologically interesting about it, which is a different approach than education and sociology. And so with education, you can start with the social problem and end with addressing the social problem, and you can just look at how people have tried to address that in the literature. And in sociology, it begins with the social problem that motivates some sort of theoretical interest in what the issue is and what others have said theoretically about that interest. And so the outcome isn't about addressing that social problem, or if it is, it's tangential to understanding what sociological implications there are for theory and how your research question is theoretically interesting to expanding the knowledge base. And then you can throw in a hook if you're an applied guy or female and be like, okay, this is why it can help us understand this pressing issue, and this is the contribution that it's making aside from just expanding sociological knowledge.
I also add that what Rachel said about, we make a leap from undergrad or to a PhD program. We're basically joining a professional guild, and we have to have a research idea or a set of research interests that is going to sustain us for a life course, in the arc of our careers for many years. So you have to feel really passionate about a set of questions or interests that are especially curious to you in a very personal way. Should be the guide. Because you're just like, we're like, you know, you don't go to a PhD program just because, you know, you want to spend a couple of years of your life doing something, learning books. It's like actual professional training for a lifetime of academic production. So you need to really have a good honest talk with yourself. Like, what am I really passionate about? What things I'm going to still be passionate about 10 years from now? And let that decide where you'd be interested. And if you have people in your department who also shows interest, then that makes it easier for you to decide, okay, what puzzles are out there? My advisor, Eric Wright, he always thinks about puzzles. You know, what kind of puzzle are you trying to solve? What's the puzzle here? What's the question? My research and his interests kind of overlap a little bit, but not a lot. I had to basically take independent core credits, reading credits, to find out what the literature is. So at least everyone here around this table, whatever their research question is, it overlaps at least with two ongoing conversations in the field, if not more. So, you know, find out what those conversations are, find out who the authors are, what they're talking about, how they approach the same questions, your own question, and, like, what is your critique of them? What is your, you know, how can you, what is missing in what, you know, you're going to ask into the conversation that's not already there, what is it? You know, what is it that you're going to do is different, where how you can contribute uniquely to this ongoing set of conversations, you know, but know what the conversations are, at least two or three or four of them, and then read them, study them. I use those questions I use to determine who my prelims are going to be, you know.
I was also going to say for a master's thesis, just pick something and get it done, because I think especially when you're early on, you can't just like wait until you feel like you really understand the state of the field, and you just need to pick something to get practice doing a research project and seeing it through. Like, it doesn't, I think, like, my thesis was huge, but it ended up becoming my dissertation, so it sort of worked out, but don't do that, because it took me a long time to get through that part of the process.
Yeah. I think listening to you makes me feel like my graduate school experience maybe constructively added to the conversation. But before I say that, I will say there's two kinds of theses. One is kind of a pretest for your dissertation, and the other is one that has nothing to do with your dissertation, and they're both reasonable. So, short version, I wrote a senior honors thesis, and then it was basically, with revisions, accepted as a master's thesis in my graduate program. So I was done with my master's in 1 year, and then I submitted the paper to a competition, and I didn't win. I got honorable mention, and it turns out I got an R&R for that, but I didn't realize that it was an R&R. Nobody told me, oh, if you revise this, it'll get published. And for a while, it actually got cited because it was the first work that had ever been done in the field. It was later replaced by, you know, other people did the work better, so I ceased being cited. But so, you know, part one is I actually had a research project early on that was worth something that never got published because I was too clueless to know what was going on. That was about women and cross-cultural study of women and men's power in societies. I developed from that project, there was a specific little interactional finding, which was that women's power was, the relationship between resources and power was stronger for women and was not translated when men were organized and women were not. Women's resource contributions translated into power only when they were collectively organized, or at least nobody was, right? So then I got interested in collective action. But at that time, there was this concept of social cohesion, which encompassed the idea that people act together collectively, along with all these other warm, fuzzy things. And it was impossible to ask the empirical question, what makes people act together collectively more? So I flailed around in graduate school for a while, thinking I had a question, but all the professors just going, this is boring. And I was also a smartass, so I didn't bond very well. I mean, I was a feminist smartass, and so I was getting all this crap for being an uppity woman, but also I was a smartass, and so my fellow students hated me too. It was sort of I have all these things about don't be what I was in graduate school. So really just lost intellectually, and then I went back to my undergraduate institution, and the person who chaired my, I actually worked closely with two faculty members when I was an undergrad, but one of them said, oh, you should read Mansur Olson's Logic of Collective Action. That sounds like what that is. And I went, oh, great. You know, so I started reading it, and then it was, and it kind of created the theoretical structure for my dissertation, and because this one professor wouldn't work with me and dumped me on somebody else, I had a professor who actually hated me as my advisor, who was actually not wanting me to succeed, but I sort of got my dissertation done over this person's passive aggression, but I mean, it was actually a horrible experience. But I did kind of have this vague idea that was ill-formed. Got my first job. By accident went off to the famous Vanderbilt Conference on Social Movements, which none of you know what that is, but it was all these resource mobilization people in social movements. Suddenly I met all these people who were interested in my work. I had intellectual ideas in common with these people at the Social Movements Conference about collective action. Suddenly my theoretical work on collective action meant something because it fed into this community of people who were actually interested in it. And I actually got post-PhD mentored by a bunch of senior people in my field who really helped me because they were excited by my work. But it was like the connection between, you know, at North Carolina, nobody on the faculty gave a crap about what I was doing. They thought it was boring, uninteresting. They thought I was a pretty good student, so they passed me, but it wasn't like anybody liked me or cared about me. In fact, one person was actively trying to sabotage me. But when I found the community, then it made sense. And that's why I think it's a story perhaps being worth telling, because sometimes you will find the intellectual community in this department, but you may still have an intellectual community if it's out there somewhere in the profession. And that's another way to realize what your work always means something relationally, you know, not just to yourself, I think.
Right.
You know, if you're only writing for yourself, that's kind of insane. You're writing to some other people, and when you find those other people that you're writing to, you're interested in their work. It's not, you know, you're interested in their work, they're interested in your work. That's your intellectual community, and then that's who you're writing to. And the trick is, can you find it? But I feel like if you have a passion and it doesn't seem to connect with people in this building, then you're trying to find out, well, is there some other community it connects to? Who are those people that would connect with your passion if you really believe in it?
I mean, I think that there's like no one process through which like coming up with the research question. You know, I think it's like it's motivated by a lot of different things. And it's, you know, again, it really starts off with figuring out what is your concern, what is the social problem that motivates you to ask that question. And then if you're in an applied setting, you can ask that question, or if you're in a more theoretical setting, then, you know, how is that question theoretically interesting? And you frame your research question to make it theoretically interesting. Or, you know, in education, if it's an applied question, then, you know, you can address that question. That's like a very general what the process looks like or whatever. And so I think what Rachel and Richard and Pam have talked about are the different experiences about what that process looks like on the ground.
I would, I mean, and sorry, you want to say
something? No, go ahead, Richard.
No, I think there's also something to say about distinction between a project you start, like your master's thesis, and your dissertation. I think they're two different beasts. And I echo what Rachel said in terms of like just getting a master's done and try to do something and like setting the publication but don't just try to get published anywhere. You know, like go like the, like just have experience publishing the next process. But when it comes to dissertations, I spent like a good couple of months trying to figure out like hone down my topic. This is big project and I was like, okay, that's not gonna work, I'm not gonna get this done, and I had to whittle it down, but I had to like go against my own resistance to like letting go of like bigger scheme, and then I should like break it down to something that's actually feasible, I can do, actually can execute in this timetable, and actually it can speak to other people in the field. And so it had went through a bigger project to a much more manageable project, and so the practical concerns, not just your interests, also dictated what topic I actually chose. And so where I am now is kind of like a one angle of this larger program or canvas I was thinking of back in the beginning, but it's still talking to it, but in much more like reduced way.
Yeah, and I think
my master's and my what will hopefully be my dissertation project, if all works out, it's completely different processes. So the master's, I had my data first and I knew what I wanted to study, and then I changed my questions after I kind of went through it. Not dramatically or anything, but framed it differently. And it was a good process, and it was a somewhat long-term process. My advisor said, like, well, you know, I think this would be better framed in this way, or these are really the questions I see you asking, even though you're not explicitly asking them. And so it worked out that way, whereas after kind of reading all the literature and just being comfortable, and I think what Richard was saying at first about, like, where are you in, you know, in your field, and where do you want to orient yourself, knowing that comes way later. And so I think that's also a sign of when you're ready to be on the job market or take those next steps, is when you know what the field says and where you know. And that, you know, you won't know until way later in the process, and that's okay, because I think part of doing that is kind of struggling your way through it. So I don't think it's a problem kind of if you don't have, these are my two research questions, these are my three. I felt like that even now going through starting my dissertation saying, like, what are my three chapters? I don't know. You know, so I can't start this project unless I have everything organized and I know what each thing is going to be about. And it's unfortunately usually not, you know, that neat and tidy. So I think that, especially for the master's, I kind of figured out what was doable, like what I could actually read through and analyze and whatever that methodology is, something I could actually do that wouldn't just stress me out. I wanted to get my master's done that year, so, you know, this was the data that I chose, and then kind of kept working at it and did different drafts. So I think, and that worked really well for me. For the dissertation, then I knew the literature, so I said, I know this is the question I want to ask because this is what hasn't been asked, and I really want to see research on this. And I wish someone had done this research so I could utilize it, but they haven't, and that's what I want to do. So it was a lot simpler to come up with the research question first later on in my graduate school career. But yeah, either process, it's not easy, it just happens differently, I think.
Going back to the question about what you would do 3 years from now before, I want to add some other things. One of them is definitely teaching, doing some teaching, and like being strategic about when you teach. So I taught 2-3 years ago, and that way I had a new kind of space to do my writing and research for dissertation. Second thing is, was I applied to a lot of awards. Paper awards often, and I found out this ASA when I was doing my interviews that someone actually said that they were watching my work. But I know, how can that be possible? I haven't even published anything. But apparently, it must be like enough. Your work gets out. You do it enough times, people read your work. A lot of people who are really important in your field, who run those committees, who for the sections. So even if you don't get an award, it means you're still circulating your work out there in the world, and people who are still reading it. So I think that's been an unexpected way which I get known outside of the department, and also which I'm building my community of scholars who may have a more understand my questions better than people who are actually here in the department.
You know, another thing that's I think it's part of building the community of scholars is conferences. And one of my frustrations is if you are CDE, you can go to you get your way paid to conferences. If you're over in community and environmental, you get your way paid to conferences. We have less conference funding in the center of the department, which is a frustration to me. But especially early on, the regional or smaller, cheaper conferences are still conferences. And I really think getting out of this building and going off to conferences is really important. And I know some people don't have a lot of money and it's hard to do, but then even trying to go to the regional conferences that are close enough you can drive to them and sleep on somebody's floor, it's a way of meeting people who share interests, if you're lucky. You can go to a conference and you're just like, oh my God, I can't stand these people, I want out of here. You know what I mean? I've gone to conferences where I thought the other attendees were really boring and it was a bad experience. But I've also gone to conferences where I was interested in what they had to say as well as other people being interested in what I had to say, and it was actually a really positive experience. And in my first job, I went to a lot more conferences because they actually paid for travel. Wisconsin is, for a major institution, remarkably cheap. And does not fund faculty travel. I really honestly, thinking of yourself as a professional and trying to get out the door and into these conferences really helps. I mean, we've got one of the students I'm advising has been going to conferences since year one, and is more networked than I am. I mean, this person, she's getting invited to international conferences on work that we're collaborating, but she's the one whose name is known because she's out there meeting people and knowing people. And it's a little bit of chutzpah to be able to make yourself do it, but it is, you know, Professor Zinn makes this point too, that you should know people who aren't just your own professors. It's a big part of it. And the only way you're going to meet them typically is out at conferences.
Yeah. A laugh.
Is there any more questions?
Let's see, relationships, research. I'm just looking to see if the notes people brought up at the beginning. You know, we could do things in Brown Bags more where we just make everybody be able to give their elevator speech. Even a first-year student has an elevator speech. And we could just force each other to do our two-sentence and five-sentence and one-minute versions of our elevator speeches.
I think that's one of the best things I did for the preparation for the ASA and the interviews. I spent a lot of time actually, like, reserved this room. I did, like, I recorded myself. I had a script I wrote up. I mean, I just prepared the hell out of, like, my elevator speech. And it came in handy. And I was, like, really polished when I talked to people. And it just came right out with my program.
And I'll tell you.
It made an impact, I think.
Having interviewed a lot of people, I can tell you, somebody who cannot explain their dissertation in less than 15 minutes is really hard to interview. I mean, I have interviewed people that I'm just like, you know, I can't do it. I mean, it's like you want a couple minutes, and then you want to pause so you can ask a question, and then they'll say a little bit more, you get dialogic. And the people who just monologue you for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, it's just like, so...
It's always better to start with less and have people ask questions.
Right, exactly.
But to have, you know, have answers, right?
Yes.
To have the, but to be able, honestly, to be able to do smaller speech bursts.
Yeah.
And that's what I found. It was a process of actual professionalization myself to actually go through the, be forced to actually figure out how can I communicate my work in short terms and like in a more abstract level than I've been thinking about ever, than I ever thought about it, like in more general terms. To a general audience, and that really helped me kind of phone and hone my identity as a scholar. Just going through that process, being forced to, compelled to do that, actually was very beneficial to myself, my own professional identity. It actually gives me more confidence now that I'm writing my letters, and like I have a clear sense of who I am I didn't have before going to ASA and making these preparations. So it's very good.
Any more first-year questions?
First year.
How do you survive the first year?
It's happening. I'm surviving.
Yeah. Sleep, eat.
Yeah.
Do not try to do it on no sleep. This is not a winning strategy.
Make a lot of friends. Best time in first year or second year, like a lot, you know, hair on the side of sociality, hanging out with people, because you need them in the long run.
I would say, yeah, I mean, so there's one of the things that we should, I don't know, necessarily talk about here, but I know from talking to students is that often the cohort will kind of bond, but there'll be one or two people who just don't fit that bond, and then they feel really isolated and terrible, you know, and I think it's somehow, collectively, we all need to notice that not everybody is part of the same glom, and that not everybody's going to network around drinking beer or whatever the thing is. But yeah, it's really, there's even research that backs it up. People on fellowships often have a harder time integrating into graduate school than people with jobs, because if you have a fellowship, you could just wander off by yourself. And there's a really important need to actually form bonds with fellow students and bonds with faculty. And so I would say if you're clicking with, you know, your cohort and clicking with the people you work with, that's great. But if you're not clicking with them, then try to, it can be hard if you really are, I mean, if you really hate the people you're with, this is really a problem. But, you know what I mean? Because you need some kind of community that is actually part of integrating into graduate school, is actually talking to people. Mm-hmm. And the social isolates who really hate everybody around them usually don't do very well in school because they don't know, even if they're smart, they just don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was sort of that kind of problem. Mm-hmm. You know, partly I had a fellowship and office space was scarce, and I didn't have an office in the building. And I just by luck of the draw, I'd gotten a two-bedroom apartment with my husband, so I had a place to work at home. And so I never really bonded very well with my fellow students, and so then they just thought I was a complete jerk, which was partly true, but I didn't get the opportunity to like provide additional information that although I was a jerk, maybe I had some redeeming qualities, but it did hinder my career. that I didn't have those networks, actually.
And so much information shared informally through the networks you have in grad school that you don't get otherwise.
Yeah, or if they're not the classes. I mean, I know there have been a lot of student-run classes in this very room.
Yeah.
Studying for prelims together. I know I would have gotten through them without study groups and support. So I think, yeah, that's incredibly important. Even if you're not doing that work right now, it could very well happen later and be crucial. I would never have kind of progressed at the same pace if it weren't for, and not only in my cohort, kind of, you know, people who are just kind of in the same process, whether you're all taking prelims or you're all, you know, working on the master's or something like that, having those group spaces, whether it's writing groups or study groups.
Yeah,
or
I definitely
wanted
to say writing groups. I have often had like multiple writing groups at once. Like I have like 1-2 person writing group where we basically are just like, did you write today? And we just like we have like an online spreadsheet and we follow each other and make sure that we're like, we like write down how much we've worked each day to like push each other along. But then I have been in another writing group that's like more methodologically like aligned with what I do, and then I have another one that's, and they're not like all at the same time, but they've been, at times I've had all at once, another one that's more theoretically aligned with what I do, and I just think, like, I am very deadline-driven, and having a writing group where I have to have something ready and get it to my group and just getting feedback, even if I think it's terrible, it forces me to, like, get something out there and hear from other people, and so I think having those relationships, and even if you don't know the people yet, just forming a writing group can be a great way to do that.
Yeah, last year's PhD graduation had all these 4 people thanking each other from the Get It Done dissertation group. You know, and they were, they don't have intellectual work in common.
Yeah.
What they have in common is that they'll hold each other accountable to get stuff done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the research is that a writing group that's too nice that isn't all that helpful, that you need a writing group that actually will yell at you if you're not meeting your deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
If people accept your excuses, that's not actually a good writing group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My writing group, you sit down and actually write. It's like a 4-hour thing. So it's check-ins at certain times, see how everybody's doing. They met their goals for the week, we set goals for the day, set goals for the week, and we meet weekly. So it's, and then sit down and write for the rest of the time. So, but every model's different. You know, check-ins, sometimes check-ins are what you need, you know. And then writing on your own, so that's really helpful. But it's also some days, you know, we might need a longer check-in or feedback or something like that, and it's less writing time or something else. So it's just kind of based on the week. That's really helpful too. But I guess I didn't start a writing group until prelims, maybe around. I wish I had done a little sooner, but I figured I have classes and we have papers at the end of them, and you know. I guess
right,
I know my son. Yeah, so I don't know why. I wish I had, but yeah, it was more when I felt a little bit more isolated because I wasn't taking courses anymore or I wasn't teaching during a semester, so other structured things where I felt more isolated and I needed those deadlines or needed that structure to like, finish things, which I think happens later for many, many people. I'm on fellowship this year, so I feel way more isolated than I did, even because I used to teach way more, so... So the writing group has been really important, and things like this is real. Going to these every week is really important. So I try to make those kind of deadlines, if that helps. Which also really helps with research questions. Talking really helps with research questions and getting to those next stages. I find, even if I didn't come in thinking that I was even going to ask a question about my research, something somebody said might kind of really jog my memory, and it helps with the progress.
You know, I was realizing we didn't even talk about the question of whether course papers could be drafts of something that might turn into a publication. I don't know if anybody's had any success with that.
I always intend to.
But it doesn't. So, I mean, the way I think of it, I think if you think of it as a publication, it's like way too much. But it could be a conference paper,
mm-hmm.
or it could be a proposal, or it could be a front end of a project.
Right, lit review.
Lit review.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've had it feed into my master's and larger projects, so which eventually turned into a publication, but not as its own project. Kind
yeah,
of
I was just thinking, I mean, it's we encourage people to think that way, but I think it can be overwhelming to try to think that way. But I was thinking that's why, you know, a lot of conference papers are basically written in 2 days. You know, they're, you have an idea and then you knock it out, and that's more like what a term paper is going to be than a publication, which is usually revised like 45 times. Anyway.
Well, thanks to David and Rachel for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Thanks, you guys, for coming. Probably found it useful.
Yeah, definitely. What's next week?
Next week?
I will pull it up and we'll answer that question. It is a speaker. I think it's Chloe, but let me see.
Mm-hmm. I'm here every other week, so.
Yeah.